And now we step into Diabetes and You, and we're joined by Dr. Danu and his team. Good afternoon to you, and welcome.
How are you doing this afternoon?
I am good. How are you?
I'm good. And I want to welcome all of our listeners and even our viewers on Facebook. And we have a very special show today. We have a very special guest. And we're glad to have our guest with us. But before I introduce the guest, as I usually do, I want to let our listeners know what's happening at the association. We are in the midst of our sixth form internship program. We've started the program a few weeks ago, and we have 36 young people from across Trinidad and Tobago, chosen from a pool of 800 applicants. The best of the best, I would say, and they're going to be with us for the next 2 months. They're going to be working with us on a lot of projects, outreaches, activities throughout the country. So look out for all of the work that they are doing. One day they're going to come visit Freedom, I'm sure, at GML, and we're going to have a good time there, of course. But lots of activities, lots of projects, lots of outputs from them. They're going to be raising funds for one of their previous colleagues who has sadly been diagnosed with cancer. He was an intern 2 years ago. So that's one of the projects we're doing. We're continuing the work at the association, all the screening activities, blood sugar testing, blood pressure, HbA1c, lipid, PSAs. Soon we're going to actually be having an HbA1c test that is cheaper than any other place in the country. Hopefully next week I could announce that. So we want to have everyone access that HbA1c test. So I'm hoping to get that done by next week, and I'll let you all know. And of course, we continue our diabetes eye screening program across the country. We are, I'm not sure where the locations are, but I'll show the locations a little later on. But if you do need that free diabetic eye exam, that retinal screening, picture at the back of the eye, give us a call at the association at 607-3288. And of course, any of the services that you want to get, you could reach us at that number, or you could give us a follow. You could visit us on social media, on any of the social media platforms. So I don't want to take up too much time because I want to get into the meat of this matter. I want to introduce our guest, and I believe it's the second time he's joining us on the program. I needed to have him join us for some time because he's the author of a book. Now, who I'm speaking about is Prof. Rohan Maharaj. And physicians across the country would know that name. Researchers across the country would know that name because he's a titan in family medicine. He's a professor of family medicine at the University of the West Indies, and has, I believe, started that family medicine program at the UWI. And he's a prolific researcher, authoring many, many papers over the last few decades, I would say. And of particular interest is alcohol. And that's what we're going to be talking today about. And it's quite fortuitous, maybe, that our Prime Minister would have spoken recently about raising the age of legality for alcohol consumption. So we'll touch on that as well. I know some of our listeners may want to ask Prof. Maharaj some questions, but I would say this is the expert in Trinidad and Tobago on alcohol, and he's written a book on it. So I have the book here. We're going to be talking about the book today. The book is called Rum Songs and Other Alcohol Issues in the English-Speaking Caribbean. So I want to welcome Prof. Rohan Maharaj to the program. Prof, thank you so much for taking this time to join me again today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Andrew. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and have a chat with you.
Definitely. And Prof, I'm so glad that we get this time to meet and get this time to communicate and have this conversation, because again, in the public sphere this week, after Monday night, a lot of people are now talking about alcoholism and are these strategies actually going to work? But we're going to get into that. But I want us to start to talk a little bit about the book that you've written and tell us a little bit about yourself and why do you really focus on alcohol as a research area leading up to writing this book?
Well, you may be aware that for the first, I was with the University of the West Indies for about 2 decades. Mm-hmm. And I joined as a family physician when we were starting the program. I didn't actually start the program, but I was there at the beginning.
Yeah.
You may know the name Dr. Tennyson Sunarayan, who was one of the mm-hmm. one of the giants on whose shoulders I stand, mm-hmm. And who really got the program started. And for the first 10 years after having gone into practice, I realized initially that a lot of the psychological and psychosocial things that I was seeing as a family doctor, I wasn't properly trained in it. And so I set out for the first 10 years to try to identify what was happening, you know, what were the problems and how could we recognize them, and then develop my own skill set in terms of helping to manage these patients. So that was my first publication. It's called Psychosocial Issues, and dealt with things like depression, anxiety, some of the substance use at that point, but mostly around mental health issues, intimate partner violence, and so on. And then I was coming to the end of a time. I'd gotten that first book published, and I felt like I just needed a change. And one day I was listening to the radio, and my kids were now getting into university and so on. And there was this advertisement that says, you know, university students free before 10, and free transport from the university to this nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
Said, but how these people can be targeting the young people? I spend millions of dollars to get my young person to this level, and now these people just want to get this person into a situation that puts them at risk, because, you know, alcohol is related to date rape and all sorts of other things. And so I said, listen, this couldn't be right. And I started to educate my own self. What I noticed, first of all, is there weren't many people doing research on alcohol within the region. Probably Professor Sandra Reed was probably one of the key people, but she's a psychiatrist and had lots of other responsibilities. She was the head of CARIAD, which you may be aware of. This is the Caribbean Institute for Alcohol and Drugs. But she was also a lot into drug abuse, as opposed to just alcohol alone. So I said, you know, I'll start doing this work. And I started to attend a few international conferences, and then we got some funding to run the National Alcohol Survey of Households. We got $60,000 from the university, and with that, we were able to do almost 1,800 households in Trinidad and Tobago, with a lot of help from the enumerators at the government
Yes.
Elections and Boundaries Commission, you know, ABC. So they really helped us, and we got this information. And a lot of the work in two of the chapters in the book comes out of that first study. And so, you know, whenever I got opportunities early on to present to CARICOM, and even at CARICOM, even though there's a lot of, you know, they're very supportive, and they said, listen, this is important work that needs to be done. I actually have a copy of the minutes that said they would do certain things, and that's been 13 years ago, it hasn't been done. And part of the problem, of course, you know, is that there's a huge pushback from our politicians, from the alcohol industry. Alcohol is seen as a cultural icon within the region. I mean, you think about brands like Angostura and Demerara and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Very well-known Caribbean brands. And people don't want to rock the boat, because they feel that these people, they provide employment and recognition to our Caribbean community. But despite that, you know, all of our international research suggests that the economic benefit you get from alcohol is far outweighed by the cost of the harms.
Mm-hmm.
We have one of the papers in the book looks at the economic, I mean, very, very crude analysis, looking at the economic impact of alcohol on the households in Trinidad. It comes up with a maximum of about almost $450 million are spent by households in this country dealing with the fallout of alcohol. And that is, we know it's a very crude thing. I've had some economists look at it. We don't have a lot of the data that we need to have to give the sort of foundation to these kinds of studies. But so this was off the top of my head, in a sense. Just looking at a minimum and a maximum kind of thing, looking at my own experience of living and paying for certain services in this country. So I think, you know, I think there's somewhere in there the real ballpark figure between 200 and 450 million. And that's just for the households. Huh?
Yeah.
We're not talking about the impact on the roads when you have accidents,
mm-hmm.
plus the insurance companies. We're not talking about the impact on the criminal justice system when people have to go up for activities or bad poor driving and so on. We're not looking at the cost of things like intimate partner violence. We're not looking at the cost of hospitalization and all those. We're not looking at the cost of early years of life lost. When you have a life expectancy of, 72 for men, when you die at 50 and 45 from an accident, our country loses 30 years of productive work. What's the cost of these kinds of losses? So, hopefully at some point, somebody will do a proper economic analysis of the cost in our country or within the region that our governments can then look at. Because, everybody says, we make money from alcohol. But, unfortunately, I've looked at around 8 or 10 economic analyses from around the world, including some in developing countries, places like South Africa and Thailand, have done very extensive cost analysis and showed that the cost is quite enormous. The hidden costs that you don't often see, these are not the costs that the alcohol producers cover. This is the cost that society covers. So, when the evidence is accumulating as much as it is, part of the reason for writing the book is to say, look, let's present this to our policymakers. Let them start to look at it. And maybe we can start taking some small steps to changing. It's not going to be an easy process. I remember when I had my launch, my launch as a professor, the editorial at the Express said, this is a generational change, is the word they use at the end. And I think that's something we need to understand. But as someone says, every journey begins with the first step, and you need to use what you have and do what you can in order to try to make a difference.
Definitely. And I'm hearing you talking about that cultural reason, or that the ingraining in our society with alcohol. And I wanted to read an excerpt from the book. I know this is a quote from a paper that you would have cited, but I wanted to read. This is in your first chapter. It says, alcohol use in the Caribbean is a practice of almost every social and or cultural event. Some individuals may refuse an invitation to a social or recreational function if alcohol is not served. Alcohol consumption is now an integral part of the Caribbean culture, which is synonymous with fun and recreation. The staging of major social events such as community and village cricket and football competitions, national carnival activities and weddings, even funerals, almost never occur without alcohol and alcohol beverages being served at such occasions. And this is one of the quotes that stood out, Prof, because it's so much ingrained in our society. And that's where I wanted to ask you the next question, which is really, give us a little bit of a historical context of alcoholism and alcohol in the Caribbean. Tell us about, the history of rum and sugar plantation. Tell us that story.
Well, when you read around the history of alcohol, it's quite fascinating. We look back to the development in around the year 700 by Islamic researchers during so-called European Dark Ages. It was when they actually developed the process to fractionate alcohol out of wine. So for most of human history, going back to the first recognition of alcohol, the earliest known recognition at this point seems to be rice wine in China from about 9,000 years ago. I suspect that if we ever able to get details from Egypt, it may go back even further. The Egyptian civilization from 6,000 plus years before was quite advanced. But at this point, 9,000 years ago is where we set the marks at this point, that there's clear evidence of rice wine being developed in China. And almost on every continent, alcohol has been formulated. Some developmental anthropologists tell us or suggest us that humans came out of the trees in order to search for fermented fruit, because fermented fruit had the aroma. It had extra calories in the form of alcohol, which helped to give them a bit of extra energy for growth. So there are all sorts of theories. It's hard to prove these things now. Mm-hmm. But up to the year 700, the maximum amount of alcohol available out of natural production was 12%, which is what you get from wine. Beer is 5%. But when the Islamic researchers developed the process of distillation, they were able to now raise the alcohol almost to pure levels. Mm-hmm. And for parts of the Middle Ages, there are lots of interesting stories about aqua vitae, which is the Latin name that they give to this new, very mysterious and very powerful substance. And they used to use it for all sorts of things. And there's a story about a king who, when he was ill, they soaked him down in the alcohol in the expectation that he would get better. But a match was struck and he exploded. I understand he was not a very well-liked king. So it might have been for the benefit of the
intentional, maybe.
But with that development, which, you know, came out of Islamic history, we now have alcohol. And the word al, is a prefix on many Islamic words, including our current world number two tennis player, Alcaraz, whose name is the cherry, or the Alhambra in Spain. So, you know, this has been around with us for a long time. Within the Caribbean, you know, alcohol has been, some people say it was alcohol that triggered the American Revolution. There's some evidence that suggests it was a key player, not only did the so-called Boston Tea Party, but it was a major contributor to the revolution itself. Within a region, the oldest rum distillery in the world is in Barbados, 300 years and going strong. So it's a source of huge pride. There was a time when it was part of sugar and subsequently alcohol was a part of that Caribbean, European, North American trade, including with slavery and so on. So it's really been an integral part of our lives. I've heard stories, I don't know how true it is, I haven't seen it documented. People have told me that their families were paid in alcohol in Carini Limited in the past. So
I think I can remember my grandfather saying that.
Exactly. You know, so there's some stories like that, that people said that they were given alcohol as part, whether it was full payment, I hope it wasn't full payment, but part payment. And so it's been an integral part. And more importantly, because it's been there for so long, we often haven't questioned it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been like everybody do it, and I'm doing it since I'm small. And so nobody's ever stopped and said, hey, listen, what about alcohol? Do you ever think about it? And they say, no, it just part of me. But the challenge is, you know, with science is that we have new facts accumulated all the time, so we have to change our way of thinking about things. Mm-hmm. You may be aware of the recent pronouncements by WHO and the U.S. Surgeon General that there is no amount of alcohol is safe. And I mean, that's a very powerful and frightening statement where the average person listens to that. Kind of nonsense, I drink alcohol since I small, nothing ever happened. But that statement is based on one key fact, and that is that there's a straight line relationship between alcohol consumption and cancer formation, right? Whereas we know that there have been what they call a J curve with alcohol and cardiovascular disease. That's what that means is that for small amounts of alcohol, you seem to get some protection against cardiovascular disease. But as the alcohol levels go up, hypertension and the consequences of hypertension, the direct effect of alcohol on heart muscle can come into play. And so that there is an earlier demise. A very similar kind of, for your diabetic viewers, is a very similar type of statistic for diabetes, that small amounts of alcohol seem to actually protect people from becoming diabetic. But as if you become diabetic and you drink, it has a lot of adverse effects, of course, and including the direct effect on the pancreas and effects on your blood sugar control. So, you know, plus the side effects of interacting with a lot of the medicines that diabetics have to use.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that there's this change in our understanding of how alcohol is behaving. So one of the first things, of course, is this issue of cancer. Alcohol causes cancer through four mechanisms, and two of those involve DNA. The creation of what they call free radicals or high oxidative stress on the body, plus the direct toxic effect of acetaldehyde, which is the first step in the breakdown process of alcohol, then acetaldehyde, then to its excretion products, including water and so on. So the direct effects, plus it seems to, if you smoke and drink at the same time, the alcohol seems to help with the absorption of the toxic effects of of alcohol, of the tar and so on. So there are some new understandings of how alcohol is affecting us. And there are about 8 or 9 cancers that alcohol contributes to. Now, one of the big problems with alcohol in terms of how we perceive it is that unlike tobacco, there's no one key cancer that it contributes to. You know, so we knew from the start. In fact, the first real work about tobacco came when doctors were examined for the use of tobacco and the eventual development of lung cancer. And there was a clear association. But alcohol doesn't have such a clear process or a clear disease. So it's a multitude of simple of things like throat, esophageal cancers, and so on. 25% of breast cancers, that's something that we don't talk about. All women in this country worry about the risk of breast cancer. But how many times do their doctor or society tell them that if you have a history of breast cancer, it's in your best interest not to drink? Because you don't know. I mean, we don't have the test at this point that will tell us categorically, you know, your risk from drinking if you have a family history of breast cancer. But the statistics tell us that about a quarter of all cases of breast cancer seem to be linked towards alcohol consumption. If you have a family history, if you're overweight, if you smoke and you drink, it's probably best to stop drinking if you want to protect yourself against breast cancer. So one part of what's happening now is that our knowledge, as it widens, we're able to make much more careful decisions in terms of advising the individual patient. So you might tell someone who is hypertensive, if you drink, you should stop.
Mm-hmm.
If you have someone who doesn't have a family history of heart disease or of cancer, or if someone who doesn't have a family history of cancer and he's worried about heart disease, you might say to him, listen, if you drink, cut down and use a small amount. But of course, you know, because of the risk that sometimes we don't know the risk is, if you don't drink, don't start.
I'm just saying that there's so much nuances that you're revealing to us about alcohol. It's not just cut and dry about having one drink a day is fine.
I think that's what we're learning.
Yeah.
It is a complex area, and we're still trying, even among the policymakers and the researchers, we're still trying to develop key messages. So one of the key messages that for example, I was at a meeting a week or so ago, what they were saying, for our young people is drink less and start later.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the earlier you start, the higher the risk of developing addictions and challenges in your own life. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of things that we're trying to develop clear guidelines to tell patients in terms of their risk and the population in terms of their risk from alcohol. Mm-hmm.
And on that note, I know we should be taking a break shortly, but we get back, I want to expand on that because that leads us into the debate that's been happening in Trinidad with the raising of the age, soon to be raising of the age from 18 to 21. I also want to discuss a little bit about the genetics of alcoholism in Trinidad and Tobago as well, and some more about the cultural issues. Your book, Rum Songs, why do you name it Rum Songs? So the bass is in studio. We're with Prof. Ruhan Maharaj talking about alcohol in Trinidad and Tobago. Base, let's take a break, and when we get back, we'll also take some calls and some questions from our listeners.
The Trade and Investment Convention is here, July 17th to the 19th at the Center of Excellence in Macoya. Whether you're launching a new product, building a brand awareness, or driving traffic to your booth, this is your chance to reach a highly engaged, business-savvy audience with Freedom 106.5 FM, the official media partner for TIC 2025. An exclusive advertising opportunity is now available for TIC exhibitors and partners with up to 50% off regular rates, live mentions on TIC coverage, and digital promotion across our online platforms, plus social media highlights from our booth and creative ad production at no extra cost. Call 329-0393 today to amplify your presence at TIC. Only with Freedom 106.5 FM, the voice of business, the sound of opportunity. Costat is celebrating 25 years of changing lives and building futures. Choose from 80 Plus accredited programs across 5 campuses with flexible learning and expert guidance. Train in cutting-edge labs from nursing simulation to IT and science. Discover global pathways, explore financing options, and get ready for the workforce with real-world skills. Apply by August 18th. Visit costat.edu.tt and take the first step today. Costat, empowering you with future skills that matter. The Trade and Investment Convention is here, July 17th to the 19th at the Center of Excellence in Macoya. Whether you're launching a new product, building a brand awareness, or driving traffic to your booth, this is your chance to reach a highly engaged, business-savvy audience with Freedom 106.5 FM, the official media partner for TIC 2025. An exclusive advertising opportunity is now available for TIC exhibitors and partners with up to 50% off regular rates, live mentions on TIC coverage, and digital promotion across our online platforms, plus social media highlights from our booth and creative ad production at no extra cost. Call 329-0393 today to amplify your presence at TIC. Only with Freedom 106.5 FM, the voice of business, the sound of opportunity.
Yeah, folks, of course, we're back. Freedom 106.5 FM, you're listening to Diabetes and You. Dr. Andrew Daniel and his guest. Let me just give out those numbers for those who'd like to get into the discussion. 625-2257, 627-3223. And also you could WhatsApp us at 306-1065. Let's get back in.
Thanks, Basin. You let me know if we have some questions or some calls, because I know all listeners may want to ask the question to Prof that I want to ask him, which is about raising the drinking limit age. But before we get to that, and again, we were with Prof. Ruhan Maharaj here. We're speaking about alcohol in Trinidad and Tobago and his book, Rum Songs and All Other Alcohol Issues. And before I get into the next question, which is the question I really want to ask, I want to read another excerpt from his book on the chapter with alcohol in adolescence. And he says that over the past 40 years, there's not been a reduction in the use of alcohol and the practice of binge drinking among adolescents and youth. In the ESC, and I guess that's Eastern Caribbean, and the burden of alcohol related diseases remains high. So with that, Prof, I want you to answer that question for me. How much of an impact would raising the drinking age limit, I'm not sure how you describe it. You might be able to describe it better than I am. How much of an impact would that have on our public health system, on the health of our people?
So when you look at the research, not very many countries have done this. The biggest country that have attempted to do this is the US. So a lot of the data that we've gotten about this raise in age and the impact of it has been from a U.S. system where there is a large amount of data available. It's interesting that not all states have a full age of consumption of 21. Many of these states in the U.S. allow for a bit of flexibility. For example, if you drink in the home with the knowledge of your parents, you can drink earlier than 21. The real law is that where it is, and this is something that they didn't mention when the Prime Minister had her announcement, is what is the maximum purchasing age? So the difference between purchasing and consumption. And it's something that when they start to draft the legislation to address this issue, that they have to think about. So it would be good to set that maximum at 21.
Mm-hmm.
That means that you couldn't go, if you're less than 21, you couldn't go to a bar and purchase alcohol. You couldn't purchase to drink outside of the bar, and you couldn't purchase to drink inside the bar. So that's one of the things, the purchasing age. And that's certainly one of the critical components of any new legislation. The second thing is that they're probably, and I suspect that this is there's going to be a little flexibility. So if you're at home with your family, and there's a celebration and so on, that parents would probably be allowed to allow the person to drink. What this will do is at least there are a couple of things that will happen is that it's going to raise awareness that this is an issue that can't be just we all do it. People are not going to have to question, well, why was this raised? And with that discussion, there should be some education to our population. So I think that's one of the things that's going to happen, that all of a sudden people are going to have to ask the question, is this something that's useful? What the research tells us is that when they did this in the US, there was a 19% drop in accidents by young people, right? So there is a drop. The challenge we have is that we sometimes can't measure this. There's not a routine assessment of breathalyzer on all accidents and stuff. So we don't have the data. And when you do have the data, it's not published. It's not easily accessible. And I've been trying to get some data done on things like road traffic mortality. What we have seen, when I have seen it, is that about 40% of road deaths is linked to high alcohol consumption. And that's been about equal across the region. So we can expect that there's some benefits, but I really want to think more importantly at the wider societal benefits. This is not raising the age of consumption reduces what we call the availability. And availability of alcohol is one of the key things when you look at, you know, we have our shops open 24/7, 7 days a week, any day, any time. You've seen that highlight on all of our bars. So some of the things that people are talking about is, yes, can we reduce the accessibility? Do we have to have alcohol available all the time? So when I was young, alcohol wasn't sold on a Thursday and it was sold on a Sunday.
Oh.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but this was real in Trinidad. The Thursdays were because many of our weekly paid workers and laborers were getting paid on a Thursday and had to make sure they get money. So that they tried to close the rum shop so the men will at least give their wives and their children's mother some support. And then, of course, Sunday, because it was a religious day and so on.
Yeah.
That was changed. It was changed, I think in the 80s, if I remember correctly, when I think that we were undergoing some economic downturn and they thought this was a way to stimulate the economy. And so that was the argument at the time. So we have had this. And some countries, if you're in Canada, on a Friday afternoon, you cannot purchase alcohol from the licensed liquor organization, that LCBO, if I forget, Liquor Control Board of Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
But Friday afternoons, the only way place you can purchase alcohol for a drink would be in a sit-down restaurant.
Mm.
Sit down in a restaurant, unless you had it at home. But you couldn't buy it in a shop and so on. So a lot of other countries have these kind of regulations. Yeah. But I mean, when I was in Orlando recently, I was having a little get-together and I was trying to get a bottle of wine. They wouldn't sell it to me before 12 o'clock.
Mm.
Right? So a lot of other countries have these things in place. But for us, it's a free fall any day, any time.
Yeah.
You know, and a small population like ours, the economic impact is probably much greater than we are aware of. You know, and each Trinidadian, almost every Caribbean person that I've spoken to, when I tell them what I do, they say they have a story, somebody that they love, somebody, some friend who's succumbed to alcohol through all sorts of activities, whether it's drunk driving or abuse or addiction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's all part of our society. And because it's that doesn't mean we shouldn't, you know, make it, open it up to daylight and to scrutiny. And that's what this book is really about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
An opportunity for us to say, listen, you know, our knowledge and our relationship has to change because the information and the education that we now have available is changing.
Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing that, and I'm also thinking back to a few months ago, I was in Thailand, and in the supermarkets, they lock up the alcohol at certain points in the day, and they have the times that you could buy it. That's another strategy.
And there's a very powerful alcohol lobby in Thailand. I've met a few of policymakers and so on, and they've done a great job in terms of controlling, because it was a huge problem for us. So back to the question about raising the age, one of the other things that's really going to be critical is how we educate our servers and our retailers.
Mm-hmm.
So there should be a mechanism in place to educate them about why this is happening, why it is that we're changing this law and enforcing a difference. And then also, I think an important part would be, which we probably should have not been talking about, we've sort of hinted at it, helping our servers to recognize when people are becoming inebriated. In China, there's a new law that says if somebody leaves you your residence in an inebriated or drunk situation and has an accident, they hold the homeowner where they last left responsible.
Wow.
And that's one of the factors contributing to a huge drop in alcohol-related mortality and so on in China.
These little things actually make so much of an impact.
They make an impact, that's right.
But a question I want to ask you, coming from some stats that you have in a table in one of your in a chapter in your book, and that's the prevalence of alcohol consumption among boys and girls, and I'm seeing that among many Caribbean countries, more than 80% in most of the countries of children before they turn 14 have alcohol. Yep. So, what can we do now to reduce that? Is there something that we can do to reduce that?
Yeah. So, and that's a statistic that when we look at this, there's a global school health survey, which we've been doing for many years now. And I just want to highlight the work of Mr. Lawrence Jai Singh from the Ministry of Health, our policymakers, and has contributed to making sure. And he's shown in one of his last studies that within Trinidad, there's been a bit of an improvement. But across the region, we haven't seen this. Again, I think it comes back down to the sort of cultural acceptance. And this is where something I'm hoping that this book will raise some awareness and get people having that discussion. Is this the safest thing for our children? And can we help to protect them? The last column is probably for me the most scary one. And that's in that almost across the whole region, almost 40% of those who drink are binge drinking.
Yeah.
Right? Well, in terms of one of the last statistics coming out of PAHO, not the last time, but the time before, which is looking at alcohol in the Americas, Trinidad was number one among males for binge drinking. This is not a statistic we should be proud of, and we should be trying to address it. And five Caribbean countries were within the top 10.
Mm-hmm. And before you move on, you mentioned binge drinking, but there's a term that you used in the book, which is
hazardous drinking, probably.
It's all right. How much or regular they drink? They drink more than a few drinks at a certain sitting.
So the definition of binge is usually five drinks within a 2-hour period.
Yeah.
A standard drink would be like a beer, a glass of wine, or 1.5 ounces of 40% alcohol. And the thing is that the whole young people are drinking this white rum. Some of it is 70%.
Mm-hmm.
So they're drinking higher levels. So they need to know what it is they're drinking in terms of, the recommendations 5 years ago was two drinks a day for an adult, which is adult male, and one drink per day for an adult female.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, the new proclamations from the U.S. Surgeon General and WHO switch that on his head altogether.
Mm-hmm. I know some people would say they're adding up the drinks for the week and have all one time and one sitting.
That's really dangerous, because the higher it is, it means your blood alcohol concentration goes up to that 8%, which is where you will show a positive on a breathalyzer, plus your coordination and so on becomes more fuddled. Your risk factor increases.
The term was heavy episodic drinking. That's what I was trying to get.
Yeah, so that's interchangeable with binge.
With binge drinking. So I want us to before we talk a little bit more about why you chose the name Rum Songs and why focus on Rum Songs to the book, I want us to backtrack a little bit and talk about a little bit of the genetics, because we were touching on that before, and particularly in South Asian populations, and this enzyme, alcohol dehydrogenase, what does that have to do with maybe a reason why our population is so susceptible to alcoholism?
Yeah. So if you, the research has come out of places like the UK, where you have a strong South Asian. And when we talk about South Asian, we're talking about India, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Pakistan, Bangladesh. So basically Trinidadians, well, the Indo-Trinidadian population that's come from there, when they've looked at, if you have a white man, a European, and a West Indian who has this kind of origin, or from South Asia, they drink together when they go, they maybe work in the same business and they go out for a drink. What you find that over time, if you check the blood parameters, the South Asian or Indo personality is going to have effects on the liver and on their blood cells much earlier than the European. And then, so that's one level of information, that the damage occurs at an earlier level for the same amount of drinking, right? The second one is some of the work that's been done in Trinidad by Dr. Shafi, who's a psychiatrist, Dr. Jaime Montani, who was a UWI lecturer in pharmacology, and some of the American colleagues, which shows that our Afro population seem to have an enzyme that protects them from effects, right? So what happens with alcohol is when you drink alcohol, alcohol generally isn't formed naturally in the body. There's a small amount that's formed within our gut, but most of it, when you drink it, it's basically a foreign molecule. It goes and is broken down by alcohol to something called acetaldehyde. And acetaldehyde is a class one carcinogen. Mm-hmm. What's a class one carcinogen? A class one carcinogen is things like solar radiation, X-rays, and asbestos. So what that tells us is that there is clear and unequivocal proof that this chemical is a carcinogenic agent, right? So this is the first product of breakdown of alcohol. Acetaldehyde is then broken down to water and so on. But depending on how long acetaldehyde stays around, greater the amount of damage it goes on. In people of East Asian descent, Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, they have something called Asian flush syndrome, where when they drink, they get red and they feel nauseous. So they don't have a very good alcohol, acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. The acetaldehyde stays longer in the system. And what happens is alcohol then becomes a very nauseating product. So they're not going to drink again. So they're protected from the harm of alcohol, right? So they have that other population. What we seem to have, what our East Indians have, is that we have to drink more to get the same high. But in the process, more harm is caused to us because we have the acetaldehyde seem to hang around long enough, but not to make enough to make us nauseous, but enough that we have to drink more to get the same effects.
So because often I've heard people of East Indian descent boast of about how much they can drink.
How much they can drink, yes. Right? Yeah. They have to drink more to get the same effect. But in that process, they expose the acetaldehyde longer, so they get more.
Yeah, you see how interesting it is.
I tell you, it's so that's another reason why we need to have that discussion.
Yeah,
all people are being harmed, right, with less alcohol than other other communities within Trinidad and around the world. But yet still, you know, very little research. If you look through that, we're trying to do a review of what is the research. Besides three or four studies that's done in Trinidad, they're very little and the populations are very small. So we still don't have a lot of, and some of the information is contradictory. So, you know, I'm hoping that when I get some more time to look at that data again, see what's happening and see if we can get some more information. Because I think, again, it's what it's telling us is that we are at risk and we are at risk because of our genes. And that's something that I think each is in the trend. I then need to look really seriously now. What am I doing when I take these things? People worry, I'm eating, I'm exercising, I'm doing all the right things, but, you know.
So I'm really much hoping that with the Prime Minister talking about raising the age of drinking, we could open up some of these dialogues some more and have people talk about alcohol more. So that's a good thing. So I know we just have about 10 minutes left, and I the conversation is going so good, I didn't get our callers and texters a chance to contribute. So because I know we have some questions and some calls, so let's take some questions and a little bit of time we have left.
All right, so let's get those calls back in, people. You can start back to calling at 625-2257, 627-3223, and send your WhatsApp messages, of course, at 306-1065. Comments here. Alcohol in all forms is a toxin and not safe, right? Cyanide is a toxin. No amount is safe. So too, alcohol is a toxin. No, a form is safe. What are your thoughts on this, about alcohol not being safe and the toxins in alcohol?
So I think we've sort of covered a lot of this in the last few comments. The key thing is that there's a direct relationship between alcohol consumption and cancer formation. That doesn't exist for heart disease. And mm-hmm. even in the past, a lot of people in the alcohol industry have stressed on the protective effect. And when the researchers present the carcinogenic effect, they tend to, you know, that's nothing to worry about. You know, so we again, this is how we educate ourselves. You know, if you don't listen to me, go on the web, search information, you'll be surprised. It's all there. You go to the reputable sites. I mean, again, you have to know where you're looking for information. There's something called the IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And if you go to their site and you look up, you know, alcohol as a carcinogenic, they'll see this is a WHO committee that have been doing research on alcohol for the last 40 or 50 years. And, they, you know, the researchers said it again and again. There will be at least 3 or 4 reports that have said the same thing when they looked at the research, that they're seeing the same results. So,
all right, let's take this call. Hello, good afternoon. Yeah, hello.
Good afternoon. I'm Pinal, or Basket Trees here. You know, I believe that when someone is educated about something, the responsibility is now with him. But if he doesn't know, he doesn't know. Because I've seen people boasting about how much rum they drink and all of that. And I just thought that was so foolish. Because, I mean, even if you enjoyed yourself, you enjoyed yourself. I mean, I have no interest in how much you could drink. But we have seen that. But if we go about informing people about the good and bad effects of what they put in their bodies, which is basically a chemical machine, you know, these things do this to you and these other things do that and this combination and this period of time and there are these scientific studies and they can check it all on their phone and so on. The responsibility is now with the people who have been given the knowledge, provided they can understand it. So that is where it should be, I would think. Thank you.
Yeah, I think true words should haven't been spoken. In the sense that, you know, we know that there's been a huge push in terms of health and fitness. You see lots of people doing all sorts of amazing things to help their bodies be stronger and live longer. And that's come about through a lot of information and knowledge and research. And people invest their time and money into this. This is another opportunity for us to understand, you know, the risk associated with alcohol, and give ourselves a chance to sort of educate ourselves. And then from that, you know, you have to make your decision. We can't make it for you. But if you have the information, you make your decision, you do it knowingly, then afterwards, you know, you can't say that you haven't been informed. Thank you very much, Andrew, for putting up this. Anyone who scans this code with their camera can have access to a free copy of the book. When you get it, you'll see something that asks me to give you permission, and once I get a chance, I will send the book to you. So this is an opportunity for you to get a copy for yourself.
All right, another question here. If alcohol, sugar, and salt is such a bad thing, why is the Ministry of Health, and by extension, the government, legally prohibit the importation or sell and distribution of products with the above normal ranges of these ingredients?
So if you go on places like the Healthy Caribbean Coalition, there's a whole series of papers and so on that tells you a little bit about how within the Caribbean, our politicians, our ministries, our health policy people have been negotiating with the food industry. And it's been a huge battle. It's if you read in the political undertones that have gone on with some of these things have been pretty incredible. We've been trying to get them. Some people have done it voluntarily, but to try to set limits on sugar consumption, sugar in soft drinks and so on. Alcohol, the alcohol industry pushes back immensely, and similarly for salt. So this is work that's ongoing, and many of our Caribbean nations have been trying to get the large industries, because remember, it's sometimes it's not only Trinidad, but it's the whole world, North America, Europe, and some of these countries with huge amount of resources and lawyers and so on that fight back against changes, because if they have to change their product, they may change the taste and they may change the sales and then change the competition. So people are using all sorts of economic arguments to try to derail these kinds of negotiations. So it's happening, but it's a very slow and arduous process. Thank you for that question.
All right, thank you very much. This one is for you, Dr. Danu, just off topic in terms of diabetes. What is the approximate cost for the HbA1c test?
So at the association right now, you can get it for $80, but hopefully by the end of tomorrow, we'll be getting a very new machine sponsored by one of the well-known scientific companies in Trinidad, and we'll be able to offer it for $40. So a gold standard HbA1c test, which is HPLC, an HPLC machine we're using, and you'll be able to get an HbA1c test for $40. So wait till next week, we'll make the announcement, because we want to get everyone getting HbA1c tests. So by next week, we should be able to have that ready for everyone. So hold up on that.
Well done, Andrew. That's an amazing accomplishment. Congratulations to your team doing that.
Yeah, we're looking forward to having that. And with that, Prof, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you the question: why do you name the book Rum Songs?
Well, you have to attract people to your product. I deliberated on that. I mean, the proper name for that chapter is the representation of alcohol in local popular music. But I said, you know what? Nobody's gonna read that book. sometimes, you know, if you're a musician, you want to put the most attractive thing on the cover of your CD. That's what this was. It was an attempt to raise awareness. Of course, you know, you want to have a product that people are drawn to, because the purpose of this was to get people interested in the topic. Mm-hmm. And the chapter was created by myself and several medical students. And it was an opportunity for us to really explore a little bit how, you know, what are the ideas that people have when they have these songs. And it's pretty pathetic reading, in fact. It's very sad to hear how people want to drink. They drink because they're lonely, and they drink because so-and-so leave them and so on. And you know, people sing these things and put it as part of their society and let their little children sing it.
Exactly.
Be carefully about what it is they sing out. You know, when I go to little functions and people play the Rum Songs, man, it's like a floor goes crazy. It's amazing to see how people, and you know, they love these songs. And it has, I think the research, you know, we haven't done this, but other countries have looked at, have different bars serving alcohol, playing Rum Songs on one night and not playing it on another night. And what they find is when they play these alcohol-related songs, purchasing goes up. So there have been studies that actually show that these things drive production and drive consumption.
We have, and then some of the songs mentioned.
It wasn't Caribbean songs. These are like, you know, probably country and western and that kind of songs, the US and stuff. But when they did that, they see that people purchase more. So this is actually some of the hard research that talks about how music and the environment triggers people to consume more alcohol. So I expect the same thing happens when we play our songs. Nobody has been able to do the right study. We have a barman who's prepared to work with you.
So I would say one thing, that the title of the book really works, because I've had this book on my desk for the last few weeks, and I have other books as well, and every time someone come in to the office, they always pick up this one first because of the title. So I'll say it's working quite well. And I just as a reminder, if you want to get your free copy, you could scan the screen right now, those folks who are on Facebook. But we will share this graphic on our social media, on Facebook and Instagram, so people could be able to get their free copy of the book as well. I want to thank you, Prof, for taking your time out today. For joining us. As usual, we need to have you on again, because it was just half of the questions that I had for you that we got through today. So a lot more to discuss.
Yeah, it's a pleasure being here. Thank you to all your viewers and to all the listeners who called in and stuff. Educate yourself, folks. There's a free document for you. Learn about it. Next time you take up a drink, at least be aware of what you're doing. Don't just do it because everybody else is doing it. That's my best take-home message. Make yourself aware.
Thanks again. And thanks, Mace. Have a great day. Thanks for listening.
All of us, folks. Thank you very much for having me again. Bye-bye.
Yeah, of course, folks, you've been listening to Diabetes and You, Dr. Andrew Danu and his guest here every Thursday, right here on Freedom 106.5 FM from 12 noon to 1 p.m.